The reading this morning is excerpts from an article about Christian evangelicals in our current political climate. This sense of grievance and cultural dispossession, the common ground between the Donald and the faithful, runs deep in evangelical Christian history. Evangelicalism emerged from the periodic mass revivals that have burned across America for 300 years. While defining this version of Christianity is notoriously difficult, it involves at least a personal decision to accept God's grace through faith in Christ and a commitment to live haltingly, imperfectly, according to his example. After a period of political dormancy, which included discrediting slumber during the civil rights movement, evangelicals returned to defend Christian schools against regulation during the Carter administration, to defend against Supreme Court decisions that put tight limits on school prayer and removed state limits on abortion, to defend against regulatory assaults on religious institutions. Nathan Glazer once termed this a defensive offensive, a kind of aggrieved reaction to the perceived aggressions of modernity. Those who might be understandably confused by the current state of evangelicalism should understand a few things. First, evangelicals don't have a body of social teaching equivalent, say, to Catholic social doctrine. Catholics are taught, in essence, that if you want to call yourself pro-life on abortion, you must also have to support greater access to health care and oppose the dehumanization of migrants, and vice versa. There is a doctrinal whole that requires a broad and consistent view of social justice. Evangelicals have nothing of the sort. Their agenda often seems indistinguishable from the political movement that currently defends and deploys them, be it Reaganism or Trumpism. Second, evangelicalism is racially and ethnically homogenous, which leaves certain views and assumptions unchallenged. The American Catholic Church, in contrast, is one-third Hispanic, which changes the church's perceptions of immigrants and their struggles. Successful evangelical churches in urban areas are now experiencing the same diversity and broadening their social concern. Third, without really knowing it, Trump has presented a secular version of evangelical eschatology. When the candidates talked of an America on the brink of destruction, which could be saved only by returning to the certainties of the past, it perfectly fit the evangelical narrative of moral and national decline. In the Trump era, evangelicals have gotten a conservative Supreme Court justice, which is significant, and they have gotten a leader who shows contempt for those who hold them in contempt, which is emotionally satisfying.
I realize that's a curious reading. I'll explain it. But I want to start with the premise of walking together. In my description for this morning, I said that community and relationships matter. And that is the how of our community that matters. So I invite you to explore with me the how of our walking together. And as a starting point, I offer an image, a visual image of the how. You will note this morning that I'm wearing a stole. I've worn it before, and some of you may remember it on seen it on other occasions. But this morning, I wear it for the imagery. I invite you to look at it. It looks different from many other stoles you have perhaps seen. It was made for me from a collection of very special fabrics given by those who guided and nurtured my life in ministry. This is a piece of my grandfather's tie worn at my grandmother's funeral. This is the onesie of a very premature baby who I held and whose parents I sat with and who I later dedicated. This heart was created by a friend and colleague from Boston's anti-racism action team, with whom I worked on the journey toward justice. The feather, and I realize it's seen better days, the feather was given by the artist herself, a Native American, a blessing for a long, safe road. And obviously, I've only named three of four of the pieces in the multi colors and fabrics. With its multiple images and memories, symbolism, colors, and fabrics, this stole is the image I lift up to us this morning as a way we can talk about our walking together. For me, this stole represents the love of many people. And I invite you to look at it because we, here in this community of Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Hendersonville, here in Henderson County, we are like the pieces of fabric. The pieces can represent our individual lives and selves. And what would your piece look like? Would it be bright and vivid, or dark and meditative, or light and peaceful? And think of the variety of fabrics and textures, coarse and silky, velvety, simple or complex, and the patterns, the multiplicity of patterns. Some pieces would be worn soft by age and experience, while others would be new and crisp. Each of us brings our unique colors, experiences, and richness to the life of this community. But unlike the fabrics of the stole, our lives are not static. The fabric of our lives continue to grow and change as we experience life. The fabrics of our individual lives bring color, texture, richness, and variety to this community, both Hendersonville, Henderson County, and our UFH home. Look around you at the variety here this morning. We, look around, come on, you're not asleep. We are UUFH. This community is formed by the threads that link us together, like the threads that weave together the pieces of this stole. The threads, the relationships, are the heart of our community. For it is in the threads that link us together, each to each other in this community and throughout our lives. And it is the threads that unite us with the interdependent web of all of life. So let's pause to think about those threads for a moment. Thread is, who are my seamstresses and quilters here? Somebody. Thread is a very delicate subject, or Thread is a very delicate substance, light and thin enough to link two together without harming the other. Almost invisible to the eye, yet ever present. Sturdy enough to unite us even through the difficulties of life. Blending in with the fabrics and colors of our lives, yet somehow changing us by its very presence. There are certain qualities one wants in a thread. It cannot be knotted, or else the two pieces will not join together. They remain separate and apart. It can't be too weak, or else it will tear, rending a hole. It can't be too bold, because then it distorts the image that it's there to create. Relationships, likewise, require certain elements to be strong and nurturing. It is through our relationships that we come to know ourselves and that we come to grow our souls. Thus, those relationships require certain elements: honesty, compassion, respect, love. Relationships in this community and our Henderson County home must be honest, compassionate, respectful, and loving. That is the how of our walking together. So what does it matter? Well, like many of you, I have been thinking a great deal about the state of our country and our world these days. And I've been reading voraciously about how the coastal liberal elites just don't understand middle-class, middle America, and about the evangelical Christianity, the reading, that swept our current leadership into office. And I put a great deal of time and energy into sincerely trying to understand. But I had an epiphany the other day that I was going about it all wrong. I was trying to get there with my head, trying to think my way and analyze my way to an answer or an insight. And I wager that many of you are doing the same. Where you use, we intellectualize, we think. It's our norm. In our quiet reflection and in our moments of shared dialogue, I suspect that many of us are trying to think our way to some kind of answer. And right now, there seems an almost overwhelming sense of frustration that feeds our national disconnected divide. We're not talking to each other effectively. We're not listening well. It almost seems as if we're speaking two different languages. The thread that should bind us as citizens is knotted, and we are anything but united. So the other day, I was mowing my lawn and doing my weekly dance with this one hanging tree branch. You know the one. It hangs down so that I have to duck under it for several passes. And I refuse to trim it because it is doing what trees are supposed to do. It's shading its environs. It's being a tree. It's providing nest for the birds that live. It does not deserve to be cut just to suit my whims. So we dance every weekend. But this day, I was thinking. And I was so distracted by my attempts to think my way through this current situation that I did not duck fast or far enough. So the limb knocked off my hat and my sunglasses. And as I bent to scoop them up, I had a moment of coming to presence to my limb, to my yard. And it hit me. Stop thinking. Thinking was getting me nowhere. It was like this deadly spiral, the analysis of paralysis. Or the paralysis of analysis, excuse me. So I replaced my hat and glasses and continued on my mowing adventure, but this time as a mindful meditation. I came and held myself present to the beautiful morning, the birds and butterflies, the blooming flowers, the smell of the fresh-cut grass, and even the roar of the lawnmower. And in that place of mindful presence, I felt an insight. It's funny how we turn off our heads and things come. That the divide we are currently experiencing is not one of political persuasion or economics or fear of loss of our country or racism or any of the other things we think it is. It is none of the issues that hundreds of people have written millions of words about since November. The divide is a theological one. The divide is one of fundamental belief. The current divide, the current battle, is merely this century's reenactment of one of the fundamental questions of the last 1,000 years. It's not unique to the 21st century or the United States or even to Christianity. It is a long-standing theological debate, and we are merely the actors playing out our 21st century American version. The divide pits those who believe there is a chosen elect versus those who believe that all are special. In traditional Christian language, it is the elect who are predestined for salvation versus the inherent worth and dignity of all. I invite you to reflect on that for a moment. Many of you here, myself included, are what we Unitarian Universalists refer to as come-outers. And what that means is you come to Unitarian Universalism from another, usually more conservative theological tradition. Most of us come here from elsewhere. So you come outers, many of you are going to understand what I mean because you heard the messages. That humanity is inherently sinful and depraved. That humanity was born into sin and imbued with wickedness. That only some are chosen and special and predestined for salvation. In the words of one 2017 evangelical sermon that I read this week, the division already exists between the sheep and the goats, and one cannot turn goats into sheep. It is impossible and ridiculous to suggest that all will become sheep. Goats are goats and will be goats. This theological understanding says that some are worthy, but many are not. And it goes on to suggest that those who are worthy are known by their blessings and successes, because those blessings and successes are bestowed by God on the chosen. We, Unitarian Universalists, sit on the other side. We affirm the inherent worth and dignity of each and the specialness of all, with all being the key word. And as I said, this is not a new debate. It is John Calvin versus our Unitarian martyr, Michael Severitas. It is Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hands of an angry God during the First Great Awakening, versus James Freeman of King's Chapel. Freeman, who was appalled by the attacks on free will. And just for fun, I want to give you a taste of what Edwards said to his congregation in July of 1741 in Northampton. His church is still there. I used to pass it going to town when I was at college. This is not words you'll usually hear here, so I'm trying to get myself in that space. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some other loathsome insect over the fire, the God abhors you and is dreadfully provoked, his wrath towards you, like fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most venomous serpent is in ours. O sinner, consider the fearful danger you are in. It is a great furnace of wrath that you are held over in the hand of God, whose wrath is provoked and incensed as much against you as against many of the damned in hell. You hang by a slender thread, with the flames of divine wrath flashing about it, ready every moment to singe it and burn it asunder. And you have no interest in any mediator. And nothing you can do, nothing to lay hold of to save yourself. Nothing to keep off the flames of wrath. Nothing you have ever done, nothing you can ever do to induce God to spare you one moment. That's fun. Let me sign up. But see, early Unitarian and Universalism, the separate traditions, both came to clear articulation of their faith during the First Great Awakening. James Freeman and his compadres were repulsed by the lack of free will and articulated that theology that we have choice, that we have will. Universalists were aflame by the idea of God abhorring us and claimed that God is a loving God would never damn some, that if God is love, then all are saved, all are elect. The theological divide echoed again in the Second Great Awakening, which was similar to the first, but had a new component because it stressed conversion, or the death of the old sinful self and the rebirth of the new saved self. And conversion is still part of our world today, full body immersion. And it was during the Second Great Awakening that Universalism reached zenith. Our tradition was the third largest denomination in the United States during the Second Great Awakening because we were out there. We were talking. But aside from that epiphany, why do I see this current situation as the latest iteration of this theological divide? I invite you to call to mind some of the messages coming from the leadership, both explicitly and implicitly. The rich deserve special treatment in the form of tax breaks because they are special or chosen. The poor are poor because they are lazy, thieves, stupid. They brought it on themselves and do not deserve entitlements like health care or food. Women are lesser, and thus their voices in the public sphere need not be listened to. Their health does not matter. People of color are bad hombres to be deported, incarcerated, or killed with impunity. And the earth is only here for man's use, man. It has no other function or life to be acknowledged, much less protected. And the voices of resistance that attempt to logic their way to a shared understanding are ignored, disregarded, and cast aside, because this divide is not one to be crossed by logic. Rather, it is that fundamental theological divide of orientation, with one side believing that only some are chosen and special, and the other side believing that all of us are special. The moral majority and evangelical Christianity have been quietly, and sometimes not so quietly, cultivating the ground for what I'm calling this third great awakening for the past 45 years. During that time, we religious progressives of all denominations, not just UUs, but all of us in the religious progressive sphere, have ceded the public space. Since the civil rights movement, there has not been a significant religious progressive voice in the public space. We have relegated ourselves to only connecting with and talking to like-minded folks. We get together with people we like and we talk all the time, but we don't talk publicly. And so much so that many question, and it's in the press, whether there is a progressive religious voice at all. Not a progressive political voice, but a progressive religious voice that lifts up a theology of inclusion, that we are all a part of the whole. But what does it matter if the current divide is the latest manifestation of a theological divide? Why? Why does it matter? Why am I here talking about this? Because if we understand that this is theological, then perhaps we can stop beating our collective heads against the wall. Stop talking at each other without hearing. Stop using the language of logic and start using the language of faith. Our forebears, our Unitarian and Universalist forebears, actively engaged the theological divide. They spoke out loudly and proudly. They proselytized sometimes. Some were circuit riders who rode into town and engaged in stump preaching contests, literally pulling up a stump, me here and you there, preaching to win the hearts and minds of those in that town. They held public office and governed from their faith. They actively engaged their communities. And these were not discussions, debates, or contests about politics many times. No, our forebears debated about faith, about belief, about love, about the nature of humanity and our world and our earth and what it means to live well. We inherit their wisdom. Our principles and purposes that we read this morning start by affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of all. If we call ourselves UUs, we have declared our position on this theological divide. And we must draw strength and inspiration from those forebearers. And here's the challenge. And re-enter the public sphere as people of progressive faith, articulating an alternative theology and affirming love for all. Not stepping into the public sphere, though you, I mean, welcome to do so, as progressive politically, but I'm encouraging you to step into that public sphere as progressive religiously. Then we can join Reverend Barber and his ilk in talking about the least of these. Then we can stop shying away from Jesus and reclaim his message that all are worthy: lepers, tax collectors, prostitutes, and Samaritans. We can claim Amos, who exhorts that we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And we can echo Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares and learn war no more. Now, I know this is a big challenge. I realize religious language may not come easily to many of us religious progressives. For 40 years, we haven't had a position as a church in the public sphere. We haven't been taught to talk about it. We haven't been encouraged to talk about it. We don't have practice or language. This is new. We may believe in our hearts, we may talk here, that God is love, that all are worthy and special, that we are called to care for the least of these. And the truth in the words from the Beatitudes that said, "When I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was sick, you visited me. And when I was in prison, you came to me." We may believe, but most of us are not comfortable talking in such language. I get that. But we need to practice. We need to risk and step out. Because I am convinced that logic alone will not turn the tide nor cross the divide. This is a theological divide which requires theological understanding, theological framing, and the language of faith. It cannot be only numbers and statistics and how many millions of people are going to lose their health care. It must be relational, personal, engaged, and faithful. That is the essential how of our walking together as a nation at this time. Now, in November, in the immediate aftermath of the election, I challenged us, I stood right here, and I challenged us to be neighbors, to engage with our fellow residents, to talk and not debate, to seek common ground. And a lot of time has passed since November, and I had that epiphany, and I've grown in my understanding. It will not be talking alone that restores our connection. It is crucial what we talk about. It is crucial what we say. At my job, about a quarter of my employees voted Republican. And remember, these are people who do the work of caring for the least of these every day. As the healthcare debate has unfolded in recent weeks, which would be absolutely devastating to the vulnerable, even in North Carolina, which did not expand Medicaid, as it has unfolded, it's been a very tricky conversation at the clinics. I'm the executive director at the free clinics, for those of you who are guests. Should have said that. As a safety net organization, we are being advised by our national and state leaders to prepare for a 30% influx of new patients should the Affordable Care Act be repealed. 30% by year's end. We care for 2,000 people. That's 600 more people by the end of the year. It's a lot. It's a lot. This is a conversation that I must have with my staff, board, and volunteers, but one that I must have without politics. So try that one. I have been tap dancing for months. But where I have landed, the dance step that unites is the least of these. Is that phrase. Theological language, even in a secular organization, theological language brings the team together to focus on mission without the political divide. Have I changed anybody's mind should the election reoccur today? I have no idea. And that's not the point. But I have and will continue to articulate that our mission at the clinics is the least of these, and that the potential policies being debated threaten the very people we are called and paid to serve. The clinics, the free clinics, is based on the premise that all are worthy. Our mission statement is framed in non-theological language, because it has to be, but fundamentally it is a theological statement. And in our case, despite the political persuasion and differences, it is a unifying statement. Henderson County, I've said this before, Henderson County is a community that embodies care more than any other I've experienced. So I invite us to embrace and use that care. We had the opportunity here to remind our conservative neighbors that Jesus called us to care. That caring matters and that all deserve our care. That love is the how of our walking together and the thread that binds. One of my best moments lately was a few months ago when a Biltmore Baptist Republican put his hand on my arm during a conversation and said, "I'm with you." Because for him, it was the fundamental dimension of care of the least of these. That our in Henderson County means all of Henderson County. Walking together here at Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Hendersonville is special because we care and we love. Walking together as Unitarian Universalists gives us a strong theological frame, historically and currently, that all are worthy, that all have inherent worth and dignity. Walking together in Henderson County is an experience of deep care. Retirees tell me they chose Henderson County because it is an engaged community, because even newcomers are expected to get involved, because Interfaith Assistance Ministries, the Free Clinics, Council on Aging, Feed the Kids, the Joseph Center, the Storehouse, and the Backpack Program are successful as volunteer-dependent organizations. And volunteers are the spirit of SafeLight, Carolina Mountain Land Conservancy, and so many others. Henderson County embodies care. We need to find our theological voices and use the theological language in our conversations. As religious progressives, we need to step back into the public sphere and remind our neighbors that Jesus did not say chosen. He said all. That Islam espouses social welfare as a principal value, especially of the poor. That Buddhism begins with namaste. And that the light of God shines in all. Let us stop trying to convince others with our logic and numbers and statistics and talk about people and care and all. Let us reframe the theological divide into language that we find meaningful and begin to engage in meaningful, caring conversations. These are theological times. And we are people of faith who have kept our collective light under a bushel for far, far too long. Engaging in faithful dialogue with our neighbors is not about proselytizing to get more members. It is about using theological language of care, of love, of all, of the least of these, to reframe these issues, to awaken compassion, to engage folks about what matters, and to walk together with the how of honesty, compassion, respect, and especially love. Amen. Namaste.